Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And in this podcast, I want to talk about the uses of the concentration camp system in Nazi Germany for creating an entire generation of SS prison guards and later genocidaires. Previously in this podcast, when we've looked at the development of the camp system, I've done quite a few podcasts on this, mainly from the brilliant book KL by Nicholas Rochman, which I'm going to look at now. We've explored this idea that the way the Nazis saw the camps were almost as kind of reform schools for the soul, that communists and troublemakers and idlers and all these sorts of social riffraff would be put in at one end, and then strict discipline and other means would transform them into worthwhile human beings. Himmler said in a radio broadcast, "The slogan that stands above these camps is, there is a path to freedom. Its milestones are obedience, diligence, honesty, orderliness, cleanliness, sobriety, truthfulness, readiness to make sacrifices, and love of the fatherland." Of course, none of that was true. The idea that Himmler had in his head was a fantasy. It is perhaps one that he genuinely believed was possible, but he knew also that immense brutality and violence were the means by which the inmates were subjugated, and instead of them becoming almost robotic-like adherence to the fatherland, they simply survived the camps, those did survive, as broken men and women. Well, the educational or transformative role that the camp had had a kind of a flip side to it in Himmler's eyes. And the camps would also be schools for jailers as well as for inmates. Initially, the camps were run by the SA in the first chaotic or so year of the camps. And there was the great dread of inmates being moved to new camps, is that they would be moved to new camps where there would be an SA man who knew them. There were some high-profile political prisoners, Ernst Thälmann, for example, of the KPD, who were absolute magnets for SA violence. And they were referred to laughingly as celebrities. But as the camp system evolved and the camp mechanisms came more and more under the control of the SS itself, the camps become training schools. Dachau particularly, the alumni of Dachau go on to run Auschwitz and the other death camps during the war. And the system of the systems of administering and bureaucratically running camps are learned there, but also every trick in the book about intimidation, control of inmates, and the use of violence, of torture, and repression, and psychological games to be played against the inmates. These were all practiced at the camps as well. Now, you might think that there's perhaps not a great deal to learn here, that being able to be brutal to people who are completely unable to defend themselves isn't necessarily an art form, and there's not much to particularly pick up once you've grasped the basics. And probably that's true, because the education that the SS men were undergoing at the same time was a political and an ideological education. So here's what Nicholas Foschtman has to say on the subject. He says, "An elite unit of political soldiers, this is how Himmler and Eich like to depict the camp SS. In peacetime, Eich kept telling his men they were the only soldiers protecting the German fatherland, fighting day and night against the enemy behind the barbed wire of the concentration camps. The figure of the political soldier had been first popularised by the SA in the Weimar years, but it was quickly appropriated by Heinrich Himmler and his SS leaders, who loved to style themselves as hard soldiers. Theodor Eich laid full claim to the term, which became so closely associated with him that after his plane was shot down on the Eastern Front in February 26, 1943, his obituary in the Volkische Beobachter carried the subheading, Eich, the political soldier." So there's a number of very interesting and illuminating things within that little passage alone. What Washman is arguing here is that the SS saw what was happening inside the gates of each camp as a battle. That an ideological war was being waged to save Germany from the camp inmates. Instead of seeing the camp inmates as the most powerless and vulnerable individuals who had no agency at all once they were in custody, the SS viewed them as an ongoing threat, that what had to be defeated within them were the ideas that they came into the camp with, lest they return back into society and re-poison this now perfected society, or society on the process towards ideological perfection, with old ideas of socialism and liberalism and all this kind of stuff that the Nazis wanted to stamp out. So there was an intense and kind of almost invisible battle being fought in each and every camp. And on the front line of that struggle was the camp SS. Now, much of this, these notions of struggle and endless vigilance, these are some of the kind of the main kind of concepts, sort of notions that underpin Nazism, that the society really, a Nazi society, is really one that is endlessly at war, either internally or externally. And if this dynamism, or this pace of this dynamism, ever slows down, really you haven't got Nazism anymore, just a kind of hyper-nationalist authoritarian conservatism. It is the endless struggle, the need to be fighting against something, that defines Nazism from other kinds of right-wing authoritarianism. In addition to that, the fantasy of comradeship, of the fighting man and his brothers in arms, which was something that a great many of the Nazis brought with them, either from the experience of the First World War, or there were those who were too young to have served on the Western Front, or those who were physically disqualified from doing so, particularly people like Goebbels, for example, who existed as kind of toy soldier fantasists, always hoping that they could have had a shot at the big at the real thing. And so Nazism was suffused with this, the kind of the rhetoric of militarism and the rhetoric of kind of male companionship and comradeship. And as such, the SS training schools within the camps were places which were kind of alive with this sort of discourse. And these kind of imagined memories of the trenches and the close bonding of men to one another meant that there was a powerful sense of them and us, and it was ideal for dehumanising the inmates of the camps, seeing them as a kind of a dreadful threat or something to be loathed and despised. And this kind of them and us group mentality made it much easier for individual SS men to carry out more and more extreme, brutal and sadistic acts. The reality with SS men or any other kind of authoritarian, fascist or brutal state-sponsored killer is that they generally aren't born like this. They generally tend to have to go through some kind of process to give them the intellectual and moral leeway to be able to perpetrate acts of immense savagery. And Theodor Eich knew this very well. He said basically the strength of bonds between the men would be matched by their cruelty towards the inmates. And these are schools for desensitising, de-empathising, and for enabling the SS alumni to get in touch with their ability to be sadistic and cruel. This is no mean feat. Human beings, by and large, have to go to significant lengths to lose their ability to empathise with the suffering of others. And this is why places like Dachau were perfect environments, training environments, to bring this out in individuals. Eich said, "In service, there is only merciless severity and hardness. Outside service hours, there is heartwarming comradeship. Tolerance," he reminded his SS men, "meant weakness. And therefore, in order to demonstrate their fidelity to the cause, in order to demonstrate their fidelity to one another and their belief in Nazism, ever greater acts of sadism had not just encouraged, not just expected, but were internalised by the SS men and therefore had to be performed in order to demonstrate that there was continuity and unity between the group. And once certain norms of violence and sadism were met, then they become the new normal, and the window of what is acceptable to do to an individual shifts towards ever-increasing levels of violence, which become assimilated as a group norm. Cruelty is also associated in the SS with the notion of masculinity. People with compassion, men with compassion, are questioned in terms of their strength, their virility, their masculinity, their sexuality. And in this way, acts of compassion were observed not just by the SS hierarchy, but by the group in which SS men existed. So it was a peer-led process as much as it was driven by the demands of the SS hierarchy.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay. With the guards at Dachau and other camps, ensuring that their contemporaries kept to the same level of sadism as everybody else. Now, from 1935 onwards, when Himmler had really gained full control over the camp empire, he made sure that he was very much a hands-on figure during the expansion of the camp system. He made sure that the camp grew in camp system grows in his image. He made sure that people like Ike and other senior figures within the camp system were appointed directly by him, and therefore the model for the development, not of the camps, but obviously the camp guards, was straight from his own particular vision. Himmler was not wildly popular with the camp SS, particularly. The camp guards saw him as the antithesis of the kind of comradeship and camaraderie that was encouraged. He had this very fastidious, bureaucratic figure who is obsessed with even the minutiae of rules. He is seen as a pedantic, bureaucratic character, a small-minded tyrant, as he's referred to by some of the men. Theodor Eich is a very different character, and his violence and sadism towards prisoners is matched by his sycophancy towards Himmler, and his determination to rise up through the ranks, his careerism, and his decision to put his own personal stamp on the camp system. He developed the camp empire rapidly from 1935 onwards. He had his own staff of five in January 1935. And by December 1937, he had a staff of 49, with large departments, with a political office, a personnel, administrative and medical office. And the nerve centre of the camp network was his camp inspectorate that was run from Prince Albrechtstrasse in Berlin, where the Gestapo headquarters also are. From the Prince Albrechtstrasse headquarters, Eich could influence what happened in any camp across Germany. And there were two key areas which he was most able to affect. Firstly was how the prison guards worked, so he could change the deportment, the attitude, the roles and responsibilities and priorities of any guard or all guards across Germany. And he could also affect the treatment of prisoners. And it was quite straightforward for Eich to introduce new penalties and punishments for new kinds of crimes if he saw fit. The camp inspectorate finally wound up at Orianberg, next door to Sachsenhausen, in a purpose-built office block that was actually built by some of the prisoners at Sachsenhausen. And this was a large T-shaped building, referred to as the T-building eventually, and the a lavish top tier of the building was inhabited by Eich himself. Who didn't spare on any aggrandizement and luxury. I like to think of himself as a hands-on kind of guy, and liked to make sure that he, alongside the men he saw himself as leading, was at the centre of active work. He didn't want himself to be thought as a bureaucrat. He wanted to be seen to be leading by example, and he wanted to be seen to be working at a hectic kind of schedule. He thought himself as a kind of a role model of this kind of dynamism and action to his men. And he said he wrote to Himmler a letter in August 1936 saying, "I live only to fulfil my duty to my troops that I have come to be fond of." And this was part of his process of keeping his men true to the idea of being vigorous and dynamic and active. The fact that it had been Ike who had effectively killed Ernst Röhm gave him a legendary status amongst his followers within the SS. And the men of the SS that Ike personally led believed deeply in the mission that Ike had set out for them, the rescuing, the saving of Germany from ideologically impure and socially impure elements. They were engaged, as they saw it, in a pitched battle that perhaps others wouldn't quite understand for the salvation of the Reich itself. Eich encouraged a level of informality, a level of breaking with rank and protocol, and once again this was a reference to the experience of kind of the front fighters, that there was little rank when it came to the solidarity of a racial fraternity. And Eich, unlike Himmler, was a very kind of hale and well-met sort of guy, a drinker, a smoker, and a guy who was very comfortable in the barrack house, which would have been beyond anything Himmler would possibly have entertained. Eich often confided in Himmler that he found himself feeling closer to his men than he did to his wife or his own family. He presented himself as a kind of like a father figure to younger SS men, and it was cringingly referred to as Papa Eich. One SS man, Johannes Haysbrook, who was picked by Eich to be a platoon leader after passing out of an SS leadership academy. He later, many years later, said, "Eich was more than a commander. He was a true friend, and we were his friends in the way that only real men can be." Now, in that comment, there seems to be something kind of encoded and hidden, which I've wondered for some time about the kind of the nature of male companionship and masculinity in general. The deep fraternal bonds between SS men and the culture that existed, which was obviously exclusively male and one where all manner of fantasies about loyalty, sacrifice, fraternity, struggle are encouraged and fostered. And it seems to be these kinds of fantasies, these kinds of imaginings and depictions of the role and the purpose of the SS that in the minds of the SS men elevate them from being mere sadists to being a warrior caste there to protect the nation and to protect one another, and to be part of a kind of secret struggle. All these are enormously appealing to the male ego, the male psyche, and particularly in the kind of the decade or two after the loss of an immense struggle such as the First World War. The failure to be victorious in the First World War presented German masculinity with an existential crisis in the 20s and 30s. And the hypermasculinity of Nazism is partly a result of this. The general culture of misogyny and homophobia within the Nazi regime and the wider Nazi culture was designed in no small part to restore German men to the position of power that they had enjoyed before 1914. Not really that power had been particularly eroded internally, but the crises of war, revolution and economic crisis had been profound challenges to German masculine pride and ego. And so cultures based around sort of hypermasculinity and the sadism and violence that go with it, it's unsurprising that they develop within this context. And so part of the whole kind of process that I started this podcast talking about, of the education, if you will, of SS men, was really the development of institutions that seem to be able to challenge or channel these forces, these psychical forces that were there, and be able to accentuate and bring out and amplify the capacity for sadism and violence. Anyway, I hope you find this interesting, and I'll continue with this periodic exploration of the SS camp system throughout the coming months. We'll be doing a podcast on Franco, reviewing the new book on him that I'll be doing a giveaway for later in the week, so stay tuned for that. And do remember to pop by our Facebook page, say hi. There's some really cool stuff I'm putting up there at the moment that I'm sure you'll enjoy. All the best, thanks, and bye-bye.